4 minutes past 11 o'clock, News Talk 97, Cairo FM. You're well on your way to being 30% smarter, my friends. In the studio with me is James Lovelock, who developed the famous Gaia hypothesis and later the Gaia theory. He's going to be at Town Hall tonight at 7 o'clock, 7:30, I should say, for a lecture. And we welcome you to our studio. Explain again, as I understand it, Gaia theory is this idea that the balance in the Earth's atmosphere is not just due to, volcanoes and rocks in the ocean, but to the living organisms on Earth, correct?
Absolutely correct.
And if the balance of life is disturbed, then so the balance of the atmosphere is disturbed in a way that you could actually see mass extinctions.
Exactly, and that's what makes it just as important to take away natural ecosystems, forests and so on, for farmland, as it is to put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Okay, so this idea that the Earth is a huge organism that needs life to survive, is that still debated, or is it accepted by most scientists now?
It's become mainstream science, but it's called Earth system science. They still don't like the word Gaia very much.
No. This is a little too moonbeamish, huh?
I think so, yeah.
You have, your new book is called The Vanishing Face of Gaia. The words, a final warning, are superimposed over an Earth that looks like it's red and on fire. I'm guessing that's not an accident.
Well, I think I should say, first of all, the words, a final warning, are not mine. They're my publisher's.
Uh-huh.
I wanted it to say, enjoy it while you can.
So you're saying that it's too late. The global warming train has left the station, and it's now time to run for our lives.
Look, I'm a scientist. I can never be certain about anything,
right.
But I would be glad to have a ticket on the train.
Well, where do we run to then? Because we're pretty much stuck
north.
Here, aren't we?
North. North.
Yeah. Well, all right. First, tell me how we got here. Was there ever a time when something that governments or industry could have done would have stopped global warming?
About 200 years ago, yes. There was a character called Malthus who said when there were 1 billion people on the Earth, about 200 years ago, there's too many. We can't go. The Earth will never be able to support us if we go on breeding.
Okay, but wait a second. I thought he was wrong, because it turns out we developed all sorts of systems for increasing the food supply and taking care of billions and billions of people, so that now, at least from what I'm told, but for wars and political upheavals, there's plenty of food to feed everybody.
No, there isn't. Not, but you see, there's plenty of people to feed everybody. If you forget that the natural forests, the natural land, is there to regulate the climate and everything else. If you take that away to feed people, then you're in for trouble.
So the minute that we started started annihilating native cultures, sustainable native cultures, we wrote our own epitaph.
In many ways, yes.
Well, that's unfortunate, because I don't see any way of undoing all that quickly enough.
We can't undo it, but we can adapt.
Okay,
there won't be that many left, but we can adapt and live, run our civilization, hopefully, in the north.
This is beginning to sound depressing, and we're only 5 minutes into the interview. Let's take a...
Cheerful person. I'm not a depressed.
I can tell. Yeah. So I'm going to give it. We're going to take a break, and then you're going to cheer us all up. We'll be back with James Lovelock, the author of The Vanishing Face of Gaia, coming up. 2.5 minutes. Stand by. 11:11, News Talk 97.3, Cairo FM. James Lovelock is in the studio, the man who came up with the Gaia hypothesis, who now says our last chance to reverse global warming and its inevitable consequences passed 200 years ago, which pretty much says that we missed the boat. So then would you then say that there's... I guess a lot of conservatives would be happy with this, because that means that all this talk about carbon sequestration and cap and trade stuff would just be a waste of time, huh?
Oh, no, Conservatives would love it. There's an immense amount of money to be made out of doing that kind of thing.
But, I mean, in terms of helping the Earth, would the, you know, all of the systems that have been proposed, either vastly raising energy prices, a cap and trade, is there any point in doing that kind of stuff at this point?
From the Earth's point of view, none. No point in doing it. But what there is a point in doing, there's one single scheme that was suggested by a New York scientist, Johannes Lehmann, about 2 or 3 years ago, and that is if we could bury charcoal in the land or in the ocean by using the biosphere to pump CO2 out of the air force, then instead of eating the plants or burning them or letting animals and bacteria and so on eat them, instead of doing that, we turned a proportion to charcoal. We would really be taking carbon out of the atmosphere for good. And if we could do that on a big enough scale, we might be able to put things back to a bit where they were.
So how would that work exactly?
Well, the only way you can reduce CO2 effectively is to use the power of the plants of the Earth, the biosphere, to pump it out for us.
But that's planting more trees then?
No. Just use them as they are. You see, if every farmer, instead of just burning or destroying the rubbish that he gets from growing grain, he sells the grain, but the straw and so on is rarely ever used as a product. If instead of doing that, he turns it to charcoal, buries it in his fields, or has it shipped down to the ocean, that way the carbon that the plants have pulled out the air is lost out from the system for good, forever. And that's the way of doing it.
So stop burning stuff right away.
Yeah.
And that would cause a substantial effect.
Not just stopping burning it. Turn it to charcoal. That's
how does turning it? I thought charcoal was burning it in an oxygen-free environment.
Right? Oh, that's right. But you don't produce any CO2 worth a damn when you do that. The carbon becomes charcoal, just solid carbon. And that won't react with oxygen. Bugs don't eat it. It's non-biodegradable.
I see.
It lasts forever. Lasts for millions of years.
So not being biodegradable is a good thing.
Exactly. For that purpose.
Then why are we... Well, then all this stuff about how all our packaging is supposed to be biodegradable, that's not helping?
No, it's making things worse, actually.
Well, why are we doing it, for crying out loud? In Seattle...
Propaganda.
We just passed a rule in Seattle that all, you know, takeout packaging has to be biodegradable, and you're saying it'd be better if it was just stayed as plastic?
Absolutely. Actually, if you use plastic bags instead of paper sacks, you're doing 50 times more good for the environment.
Would you tell the mayor that, please? Because He thinks he's all green about this plastic bag thing.
Well, the carbon in the plastic bag stays forever in the landfill.
Right.
The paper gets digested and puts CO2 and methane back in the air in no time. So it's much worse.
Well, this is the kind of thing, James, that drives me nuts. Because every you know, wild-eyed environmentalist reveres you. And here you are basically yanking out the rug from one of their accepted solutions, which is biodegradability. So the whole idea of something being biodegradable is actually doing more harm than good to the atmosphere.
In a limited way, yes, definitely. And the problem is most environmentalists are not scientists.
Yes.
They're ordinary folk who want to live well with the Earth and do good. And their intentions and their motivations are excellent. But unless you look at it from a scientific and engineering point of view, you come up with solutions that are not practical and even positively harmful.
Yeah. Do you ever comment on environmental blogs and just point this out to them once in a while?
I never blog.
See, that's the problem. If you do not blog these days, you don't exist.
Good. I'm glad. Life's busy enough as it is.
So, people, stop using the paper bags. Go back to the plastic and save humanity from certain extinction, please. And turn all your waste into charcoal so that it doesn't react with anything. So, all right, we've done that. So, but you're saying, though, even if we do all that, it's still too late.
Not if we do the charcoal thing on a big enough scale. We might just put things back. But otherwise, we've got to adapt. And it isn't that difficult to adapt. Living here in Seattle, you don't have much to do. This will be one of the favorite parts of the world when it gets hot.
It will.
Yeah. If you've got the same sort of climate as we have in the UK, cold, wet, people grumble at it, but it's just right. And it'll not change all that much with time. But the rest of the US of A, especially in the center, where, in fact, where we're just moving to, St. Louis, it will fry.
So we're the spaceship here in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you moving to St. Louis then, if you know full well as a scientist?
Well, I'm 90, so...
Oh, I are you really?
Yes, it doesn't matter all that.
You don't look 90. I would have guessed maybe in your 70s, but I wouldn't have guessed 90. You're doing okay.
I'm doing okay.
How much time do we have left before the Midwest dries to a crisp?
I wish I knew, but I think we shouldn't look beyond 20 years.
20 years?
We shouldn't look beyond it. It may happen sooner.
So what kind of temperatures are we going to start seeing in the Midwest?
It isn't so much temperatures alone, although Europe in 2003 reached temperatures in between 110 and 120 Fahrenheit for 3 months running, all through the summer, no rain. And that just kills off all plant growth and vegetation. And that's the problem. You might have air conditioning by then so that you can take it, but the plants can't. You can't air condition fields. And that if you haven't food, you can't live.
No, I understand that. So we're talking about consistent temperatures over 100 degrees in the summer in the Midwest?
It's possible, yes.
And you're saying the climate here will not change substantially, or will we warm up too?
You'll warm up a bit, but you'll still be wet. That's the key. It's water is more important than heat.
Right. So we will have enough to continue irrigating eastern Washington?
I don't know that. I can't answer that. I don't know enough about the locality.
But I mean, what makes us sustainable is that we could still grow food here.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know how much you know about western Washington, but most of the agricultural, well, I don't know most, but a lot of the agricultural land that used to be used for farms is now holding warehouses and shopping malls.
Well, maybe they'll have to remove them, put it back in farming again.
Seriously?
But the main problem would be people moving in.
Yeah, well, that's right. You're trying to survive. So I guess we have to build the wall along the Columbia now while we can, huh?
Yeah, seriously, I think you've got to prepare for the moving of people when things get rougher. And that means a lot of work building the infrastructure. You can't have shackvilles full of people, refugees coming in, because they're sources of disease, misery, and everything. You've got to be prepared to take the people, and you've got to know when to say no, when there is no room for any more.
Well, we are building, finally, a light rail system, so we'll have some kind of public transportation. Do you have any idea, are you predicting, like, how many people might want to come here?
I wouldn't dare to predict. All I do know is about Britain. I know that well. We're already overcrowded at 60 mm-hmm. millions, which is about the same population density as Greater Boston. Mm-hmm. And our government says that will double in the not too many years ahead.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Are there any villains here? Is there any, because at some point when this debacle happens, I'll probably still be doing this talk show 20 years from now when the huge migration begins. And one of the things I'll have to do is say, I told you so, if only this person, you know, hadn't said this. Who do I vilify 20 years from now when the huge migration takes place?
I think you'd be wasting your time.
Yeah?
there'd be too much interest in what's happening.
Yeah. Nobody will care who's to blame, huh?
No, not at first. That comes when they settle down a bit.
Yeah. But there is no question that actually the present generation, young 20 and 30-somethings right now, we'll live long enough to know who was right on this global warming thing.
I feel the young generation won't worry too much. You see, being as old as I am, I was a student just before World War II. And we saw the world ending shortly. And we're going to be bombed out of existence in no time at all. But it didn't quite work out like that. There were so many interesting things to do that life actually seemed to get better. And I think that's how the young will take it.
Mm-hmm. So they won't look... So let me get this straight. There will be a mass migration. Large swaths of the American landscape will become unproductive in terms of food, but life could still get better?
It's possible for those that remain. And don't think of people dying. Think of people not living as long as they might otherwise have done.
Uh-huh. So there won't be mass extinction, but lifespans might get shorter. Well, because of, this still doesn't sound very optimistic. I mean, when you say lifespans get shorter, because people will starve because of disease? I mean, what? Or
well, as I see it, we can't go on like we are. We're trashing the earth. We're overpopulating it. Something's got to give. Far better to give in a way that we can, with us adapting to change and keeping civilization going, than to just wait until we are most of us wiped out and warlords and mayhem and trouble begin. So there's a lot to do and quite a future to look forward to.
Well, I'm not sure whether to be more optimistic or not after hearing you say that, but here you are with a smile on your face, looking carefree and happy. And it's not just because you're 90, is it?
That helps. And you have to have something to look forward to if you're 90.
Yes, I guess you do. Thank you, James. All the cheerful news will be laid out in detail tonight at Town Hall at 7:30. James Lovelock is the author of The Vanishing Face of Gaia. It's 11:22. This is the Dave Ross Show. I'll be right back. News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. This afternoon on the Dory Monson Show at 105, Dory talks to the first program director ever to put him on the air. That's at 105 right here, News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM. So look, those of you who believe that getting rid of plastic bags is a good thing, those of you who believe that biodegradable packaging is a good thing, please tell me how you answer what James Lovelock said, the man who developed the Gaia hypothesis, the man upon whom a large segment of the environmental cause is based on. His theory is what it's based on, the theory that it takes the organisms of the earth, the healthy balance created by the organisms, to sustain all life, including us. That it's not just passive geological processes. This guy is saying that the whole biodegradable thing is a crock. In fact, not just that, it's not just misguided, it's downright harmful to the earth. And he was also telling me as he left that the whole wind turbine thing is needless as well, and that oil is in fact a renewable resource because it's created by organisms. Now, it doesn't renew itself right away. It takes a while for the organisms to absorb the algae, et cetera, to absorb the carbon dioxide and die and pool under the earth and be turned into oil. But in the long term, anyway, it's renewable. The best thing we could have done was 200 years ago to be smarter about the Industrial Revolution and not trash the earth's natural ecosystem, which he agrees with you on. But these other little things that we're trying to do, like cap and trade and biodegradable packaging, is a colossal waste of time. And not only is it a waste of time, it's harmful. Do you have any answer to that?